From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moskowain. Bill Cosby's release from prison sent shockwaves across the nation Wednesday as victims' rights groups grappled with what to make of a Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that found that parts of the Philadelphia-born comedian's trial were unconstitutional. Cosby's 2018 conviction on three felony counts of aggravated indecent assault carried a prison term of up to 10 years. It was seen as a high-profile victory for the Me Too movement, a mark of justice for accuser Andrea Constant, and a vindication for the 59 other women who claimed that Cosby raped, sexually assaulted, or committed some other form of sexual misconduct against them. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court's 4-3 split decision did not dispute the allegation that Cosby drugged and assaulted Constant without consent. The ruling to free Cosby hinged on the fact that a former Montgomery County prosecutor promised not to convict the comedian in a criminal case in 2005 as a way to get Cosby to answer questions during a civil trial. And the state high court said essentially that because that deposition was then later used in the criminal trial, Cosby's Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination were violated. And the court says prosecutors are barred from bringing the same case back against Cosby. Here to help us unpack the case and its social and cultural implications, we have three guests. Deborah Turkheimer is the professor of law at Northwestern University, a former New York City assistant district attorney, and author of a forthcoming book, Credible: Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you very much.
And Thea Butler is the associate professor of religious and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins us in studio. Welcome, Thea.
Thank you.
And Annette John Hall is the host of WHYY podcast, Cosby Unraveled. Welcome, Annette.
Hey, Kevin.
And a warning to our listeners, we will be discussing some sensitive topics today. Deborah Turkheimer, let me start with you. As a former prosecutor, what did you make of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision?
I thought it was a fairly extraordinary decision, both in terms of how it understands prosecutorial power and what prosecutors are entitled to do when they make public announcements, and to the extent to which that binds any successor. But then even more, the remedy that the court crafted here, the remedy in terms of barring further prosecution of Cosby, was fairly extraordinary, and I think speaks to the extent to which this court was very concerned with fair treatment of Cosby and what seems just in this case. And those are amorphous concepts that really allowed the court to import its notions of what seemed right here. That's the part of the opinion that really stood out to me.
Mm-hmm. Anthea Butler, I mean, this was a highly charged case, and we're seeing some pretty strong reactions on both sides, especially in the Black community. Curious what you've been seeing, what you've been thinking about this.
Well, I've been seeing a lot of my friends having to block people on Facebook who said they were very happy about Cosby being let out. I think for the Black community, this is another moment of challenge. And I say challenge because, especially here in Philadelphia, what we find are people who are like so happy that Bill Cosby is out. They never thought Bill Cosby was guilty in the first place. They thought the women were lying on him. And then we sit around a host of survivors of sexual abuse who are saying that this is one of the worst days ever. Mm. That, you know, seeing this man that everybody thought was, you know, the perfect Black father was actually a rapist who, you know, drugged everybody so that he could have sex with them. So I think for the Black community, this is a moment of pause. There's a lot more to say about certain Black people who are prominent figures who have said things about Cosby. But I think personally for me, this is just another moment in which we have to, as a people, think about how we think about public figures who are Black, who represent us, and the issue of respectability in the community and why respectability will not save us.
Mm. Annette John Hall, you covered both of Cosby's trials in 2017 and 2018 for our WHYY podcast, Cosby Unraveled. Curious, when you heard the news yesterday and you thought back through all the interviews you did with people who are accusers and victims and community members, what went through your mind?
What went through my mind was the Richard Allen Holmes, because I remember the first episode of the podcast we did. We wanted to make sure that we got in different voices than just the pundits that we heard on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, what made this story so quintessentially Philly was that Cosby grew up here. And so we wanted to trace his roots and go back and talk to the people who lived where he lived. And
that's a housing project in North Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's the Richard Allen Holmes project in North Philly. And so we went there, and that was the first place we went. And we found one of our favorite interviews was one of Mary Jefferson. She was there with her friend Lynn, and what she said kind of summed up the ambivalence that Black people at Richard Allen Holmes was feeling. Let's listen.
I love the show.
Why?
He was more like a father to the children. Yeah. A down-to-earth father, yeah.
When you heard the accusations of all these women...
When I heard that, I called him a dirty bastard. I didn't know all the facts or anything.
Yeah.
But,
what you think now, though?
There's two sides to every story.
Yeah.
But if it was my daughter and she came to me, I'm going to have to believe her.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to believe it.
So, Annette, what do you hear in that? You hear a struggle with what to do with allegations and who to believe, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, people, not just Black people, but everybody loves Bill Cosby. They grew up with him, no matter what generation you were in. You know, if you were my parents' generation, you listened to his comedy records. You know, if you were my generation, you saw The Cosby Show, and which ran for years,
sure.
You know. And then, you know, it's interesting because a lot of young people, they don't see Cosby the way we see him. They see him as this public moralist who is going around preaching to everybody to pull their pants up.
Right.
And so they really don't see him as this icon. But they understand his power and influence and his philanthropy, giving millions of dollars to HBCUs. They understand that. But, you know, For many of us, it's unfathomable that we could believe that he has done this kind of thing to women over 50 years.
Anthea, I saw you rolling your eyes while that clip was playing and you were listening to Miss Mary. What was going through your mind when you heard that clip?
You know, what was going through my mind in this clip was, I was just talking about this before we came on the air, about a tweet that somebody put out a couple of weeks ago that said, but they're family. Mm. And I think that for a lot of people, people feel that Bill Cosby is family, but he's the same family member who everybody tells you to go sit on his lap and he's got his hand underneath your dress. Or he's the family member that stays at your house and creeps into your bedroom at night. He is the pervy family member. He's that gross person, the teacher, the priest, or whoever it is that has molested you, that, you know, everybody loves because he's loaned money or he's helped somebody in the family. And now you have to put up with this. Now we have to accept him. But I don't accept that. And I think a lot of us don't accept that. And I think this is the trouble in the Black community right now, is that they don't realize that there is a new generation of young women and young men and others who do not accept this kind of behavior anymore, who will not put up with the perverts and the pedophiles in the community, who will not allow these things to happen anymore. I want to remind everybody right now of one particular thing that I think people are going to forget in this. Bill Cosby admitted that he gave Quaaludes to women.
Right.
He said it. This is why we're here right now, because he realized if he told the truth, he would get off the first time.
Right.
And we cannot forget that fact. And so what I don't want to see people do right now is to let this man get off the hook just because he went home. I get the technicality. I get the decision that the Supreme Court has made in Pennsylvania. But the fact is, he's still guilty.
Deborah Turkheimer, I want to come back to you. I mean, given the volume of complaints and allegations that have been made by Cosby over the years, given the fact that, like we just said, he admitted to what he did in that deposition in the civil trial, why couldn't a prosecutorial team make a case that would stand up against appeal and hold his conviction? Why didn't that happen in this case?
It's an excellent question. We can go back to 2005 and the announcement that then DA Bruce Castor made about his decision not to prosecute Cosby at the time. And he pointed to a number of factors that informed his decision. He talked about Andrea Constant's delayed reporting and how that affected her credibility. He talked about the continued contact that she had with Cosby and how that affected her credibility. And these are, of course, facts that come up in many, many sexual assault cases. This is far more typical than aberrational. And yet these are facts that often get in the way of police officers making an arrest, or in this case, prosecutors moving forward with charges. And so, you know, we can see in this respect some very patterned behavior. We see cases not making their way through the criminal justice system for just these kinds of reasons. And I think that this is really important to emphasize, that the prosecution of sexual assault continues to be more the exception than the rule.
And if, you know, the Cosby team essentially fires back, well, look, you know, you didn't prove it in a court of law in a way that, you know, could stand up to appeal. So we believe the criminal justice system worked. We, you know, Cosby made an appearance yesterday outside his mansion in Cheltenham, and basically his attorneys were declaring victory. So some are looking at this and saying, you know, justice was served here as far as what's required under the law. Deborah, do you want to follow up on that?
Sure. I mean, I think that there are really good reasons to think that the trial court was right when it denied the Cosby team's motion to suppress his deposition testimony. The trial court made a number of findings suggesting that there was no agreement never to prosecute him, and that any promise that was made actually did not induce Cosby to testify at his deposition. But even if it did, right, even if it did, the remedy that we would expect and that would be far more in keeping with what courts would normally do in a case like this would be to suppress the deposition testimony, meaning not to allow it to be used against him at trial, so at a third trial. But this high court in the state of Pennsylvania was very clear about the fact that that would not go far enough toward vindicating Cosby's interest in fairness and justice. And again, I think that that's a really striking part of this opinion. The court goes out of its way to see this from Cosby's perspective, even though a jury was convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of his guilt. It's really Cosby who gets the court's sympathy here and not Andrea Constant.
Okay, we're coming up on a break. You've been listening to Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University and the author of a forthcoming book, Credible: Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers. Anthea Butler is also with us. She's the associate professor of religious and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And Annette John Hall is the host of the WHYY podcast, Cosby Unraveled. And we want to hear from you. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Leave us a note on Facebook or Twitter at WHYY Radio Times, or call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back after a break. We've got plenty more to talk about.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about Bill Cosby being released from prison yesterday based on a order by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. In studio with us is Annette John Hall, host of the WHYY podcast, Cosby Unraveled. Anthea Butler is a associate professor of religion and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And Deborah Turkheimer is a Northwestern University law professor. You know, we've been talking about reactions in the community. We should highlight these tweets that we saw yesterday from Felicia Rashad, who essentially said, you know, quote, finally, a terrible wrong is being righted, a miscarriage of justice is corrected. And then she later kind of backtracked and made sure she, you know, put some sympathy towards victims of sexual assault as well in a subsequent tweet. What did you make of that, Anthea Butler?
you know, this is where she is about to learn that she took a deanship at Howard University, and being a dean means that you're going to adjudicate sexual assault cases on campus, and that means that she probably can't be fair to do that. And now Howard University has to figure out whether they want a dean who says this kind of stuff out loud, or they want to get another dean who might be a little bit more amenable and will understand Title IX laws. Let me translate that by saying is that she made a stupid tweet, and it was ridiculous, and she got a whole bunch of people on her, and Howard students are going to be ready for her if she is still around in 2 months.
And in that, this goes to, you know, what we've been talking about, where, you know, there's people who supported him and who have stood by him, and there's people in your own family. And, you know, we have these debates in our families about how to think about these cases, and how does that play in your mind?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I had a debate with my own daughter about his behavior and whether he should, you know, be justified in his behavior. And of course he shouldn't. But
what was your daughter's argument?
Her argument was like these women knew what they were getting into with him. When he invited them to his hotel room to talk about their quote unquote careers, they should realize what was coming and what was expected of them. And what I told her was that no woman, I don't care who you are, what your intention is, should have the expectation that they're going to be drugged and raped.
Yeah. Let's read a little bit of this statement that Andrea Constance sent yesterday. She wrote, "It's not only disappointing, but of concern in that it may discourage those who seek justice for sexual assault in the criminal justice system from reporting or participating in the prosecution of an assailant, or it may force a victim to choose between filing either a criminal or civil action." And you know,
Kevin, that was the difference between the first and the second trial, mm-hmm. was that, you know, the first trial became a hung jury because right. people really didn't think that, you know, Andrea Constance's testimony was strong enough. In between that first and second trial, the Me Too movement yes. happened. People fail to remember that, you know, the whole world shook
yeah.
with the Me Too movement between that first and second trial. Also, too, during that first trial, all these victims started coming forward.
Yes.
They started, you know, coming forward publicly. Andrea Constance's courage made it possible for these women to speak their truth. And we did put together a clip of that from our podcast that we can listen to right now about what victims were saying. It was a pattern. On June 5th, Bill Cosby will face felony charges for aggravated indecent assault, and there are dozens of alleged victims.
And from the first sip and then the second sip, I knew I had been drugged.
I woke up out of a very confused state.
My speech was slurred.
Until 2 sips.
Not in my clothes.
I
was woozy.
Naked, bruised, and battered.
I wanted to be able to just confront him and let him know that I know he did something wrong.
What do you hear when you listen to that?
I hear a pattern of behavior that has been going on for so many years. And the thing is, I mean, women don't come forward, Kevin, for many reasons. You know, they know that they're going against a rich and powerful man. There's a history of women not being believed. But when you're, and I can speak to this, I mean, just having a hangover, you know, the next day from drinking too much, it's like, what happened? Did that really happen? Wait a minute. Am I dreaming this or what?
Yeah.
When you are drugged
sure.
to the extent that these women were, when they wake up and they feel semen on them, they don't know what happened to them, you know, they would probably be hesitant because they know that the police would ask them what exactly happened to you. They couldn't say what exactly happened to you.
Yeah. If we trace this back through the history of the Me Too movement, I mean, when this allegation was first made in 2004, I mean, it was a different world, right? And you got to imagine that you're, or maybe you would hope that you have to imagine that if that same allegation was brought today, a prosecutor would see it in a different sense. Deborah Turkheimer, do you get a sense that the Me Too movement truly has changed the criminal justice system in a way that if somebody was making this claim against a wealthy, powerful person today, it would be seen differently?
Well, change is really hard to come by when we're talking about the criminal justice system and such entrenched skepticism of the word of sexual assault accusers. I do think we're starting to see change, particularly in the court of public opinion and in the conversations that all of us have outside of the legal system. But it's going to take quite some time for these new understandings to penetrate the law and to really make a change in the way the system has historically treated these cases and continues to treat these cases. For now, I think we will continue to see the difficulties that survivors face when they come forward. We'll continue to see disbelief, we'll continue to see blame and disregard, a sense that what these women suffered is unimportant, particularly compared to the suffering of the powerful man accused, if he's indeed held to account.
So why is it that you think that is something naturally within us that our sympathies are stacked against victims? Why is there like a circling the wagons mentality around certain people? Why is that?
I don't think this is natural, but I do think we live in a society that is structured to give credibility to those with power. And in particular, when it comes to allegations of sexual misconduct, which really disrupt the status quo in ways that are threatening, I think that we all, you know, this is something that's not just bad apples, but all of us have a tendency to protect those who occupy powerful positions, respected positions, people we revere, people we look up to in our society. And that, again, is culturally and legally entrenched.
And let me just say this, Kevin. We did a whole episode on enablers, the people who surrounded Bill Cosby, who knew this was going on and allowed it to happen because this was the man who was paying their salary. I mean, you know, the people who stood at the door, while he was doing his dirty deeds. The people who, you know, drove these victims around because some of these victims were underage.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he'd say, I'll send a car for you. You know, these people were on the payroll for Cosby.
I can see you have something to say.
His biggest enabler? Yeah. Let's talk about the biggest enabler there was, his wife, Camille Crosby. She's right there in the house when some of this is happening. So you know she knew what went down the whole time, but she has been serious about his innocence. And even what he said yesterday, I just want to read this statement that he said yesterday. I have never changed my stance nor my story. I have always maintained my innocence. Thank you to all my fans, supporters, and friends who stood by me through this ordeal. Special thanks to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for upholding the rule of law. He is gaslighting folks once again. He's just like he gaslighted everybody that came to his house who drank a drink. Think about this for a minute. I want people to understand that if you drink one sip of a drink and two sips and you're out, that means there's a lot of drug in that drink. This dude is the same guy who would roofie you at the club. I don't understand why people can't see this. And so this is where I'm going to disagree with my, you know, colleague, Northwestern professor here, and say this is how people are. They will side with the rich and the powerful every time over and against the person who is going to say, this person did something wrong to me. We see this in the Catholic Church. I've read a lot of these cases. I've written a lot about the Catholic Church here in Pennsylvania. All of this is a pattern. And this is what disgusts me so much about the people who decide that they need to support Bill Cosby because he's rich and he's famous. Everybody rich and famous in this country, they can murder somebody on TV and they get a pass because it's like, well, he was on the Cosby Show. It was such a great show. I mean, I think separate the character.
I think I also want to say that we agree that this is a pattern and that this is something that is pervasive in our society. We're saying just the same thing. To be clear, I think this is not natural in that it's not inevitable and we can change it. We just need to pay close attention to all of the ways in which we are wired to protect the powerful and to discount the suffering of those who are powerless and marginalized and who don't have the status in our society that someone like a Cosby has.
Then
so
we
this
need
is
to change
everywhere.
The legal system because Absolutely. That's where the problem is. That Absolutely. Is where the problem is. From the time you walk into the police station and say that you have been raped, you have been sexually assaulted, you are treated like dirt. Mm. And this is the problem because we don't train officers, we don't train prosecutors, we don't train judges, we don't do anything. And this is not just here in this country. It's in England, it's in other places around the world. It is so hard for somebody, male or female, or however they identify, to come in and say, I have been sexually assaulted. And that is part and parcel of why the legal system needs to change.
We brought up Camille Cosby. We should say, you know, when the conviction came down in 2018, she compared her husband to Emmett Till, the black 14-year-old who was lynched in 1955 after being falsely accused of leering at a white woman. And there's Cosby's wife essentially saying that there are times where accusers should not be believed. And in this case, she sees her husband as the victim. Annette?
Well, I think it was really telling that Camille made that one appearance and then she didn't show up again.
Yeah.
You know, who knows, you know, what couples accept as a relationship. I mean, she has been with this man for over 50 years. She should have gotten a clue when he did a whole routine, comic routine on the Spanish Fly, which is this drug that, you know, it's a roofie that you put in drinks that make women, I don't know what it makes women do, but if you listen to his comic routine, he explains in detail that it's a seductive drug. She should have known that about him. We don't know what goes on in couples' relationships, but it is very telling to me that she made that one statement, that one appearance in court, and did not show up for his sentencing, did not show up for the verdict, didn't show up after that at all.
I'm going to read some comments here. A comment from Diana says this is just another example of a so-called justice working for the wealthy who can afford to appeal their cases over and over again. And a question from Dan, can you clarify why the court ruled that Cosby couldn't be retried? How did they come to that decision? Can I put that one to you, Deborah Turkheimer?
Yeah, and I love this question because it focuses on the part of the opinion that I think is most striking. The court talked about the notion of fairness that underlies due process and looked at what fairness requires, what equity, meaning justice, requires, and based on those lofty principles, decided that it wouldn't be enough to retry Cosby without his deposition testimony. Rather, the prosecution could not go after him again, that this was what is known in contract law as specific performance. But what's really interesting is that the court didn't have to do this. It went out of its way to give Cosby an entitlement that, to my mind, he simply does not have.
Right. And so the court, it was a 4-3 decision, we should say. And in that majority opinion, to your point, they make that claim and essentially say that Castor, say, you know, the former DA Castor, saying, look, you're not going to be prosecuted. And even though we don't have a legally binding deal in front of us, I'm going to put it into a press release. And that right there was essentially the cardinal sin in trying to get him prosecuted. And now forever, they're saying going down that path is barred. And there was a dissenting opinion that concurred with much of what the majority said in saying that he should be released. But that opinion said essentially, he should be able to be retried again. Just don't use the deposition. So it's kind of an interesting legal thing that's happening in the case. And it's where we are now. Anthea Butler, what's your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm of two minds about this. One is I love them to retry him again because I think he should just be put through it as much as all of the people who he had been abused have been put through it. That's number one. But I also realize that giving him air and attention gives him, a base, a way to still speak to the community. One of my followers on Twitter yesterday joked that he'd probably be on, I will not name the station, some conservative station, talking about pound cake and pulling your pants up again and everything. And I think that's where he's going to go next. He's going to be back saying the kinds of things to the black community and others that he thinks are important and the kinds of things that he learned in prison. But, you know, I have to just say this and be really honest about my feelings. I would just like him to go into the dustbin of obscurity. I am so sorry for the women who had to endure abuse and rape at his hands. I think that he, you know, I don't know what kind of psychological problems he may or may not have, but I think that it's very telling that a man of his stature and his position had to drug people to make them be with him. And I don't think anybody in their right mind would think that anybody who was a star had to do that.
We have a call from Harold Gordon on the line. Harold, what's your question?
it's more of a comment. I'm glad the conversation has steered away from race a little bit, because I don't think it's about race at all. There's four men that all have the same commonalities. Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Cosby, and Donald Trump. They're all rich. They're all powerful. They're all sexual predators with like dozens of accusers. And I think they're all sociopaths. None of them have admitted or accepted wrongdoing. And so I just think it's about that. No one's talking about these white predators as it has something to do with white. I do have two quick questions. Number one, how did the three women on the state Supreme Court vote? And also, since this was reversed on the technicality, does Bill Cosby have to register as a sex offender?
I can answer the question about the Supreme Court voting. Two women sided with the majority. One sided with, essentially said parts of it were true, parts of it we disagree with. And the person who fully, disagreed was the Republican Chief Justice Thomas Sailor. So I can speak to that one. Do you guys want to take up? Well, you know, we are coming up on a break here, so why don't we get into some more of Harold's question after we take a short break? We are talking about the Cosby case here with Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University and author of a forthcoming book, Credible: Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers, Anthea Butler, associate professor of religious and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and Annette John Hall is the host of the WHYY podcast, Cosby Unraveled. We want to hear from you. Email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Call us 1-888-477-9499 or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter at WHYY Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you're listening to WHYY's Radio Times. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the fact that Bill Cosby was released from prison yesterday based on a Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that essentially said that Cosby's Fifth Amendment rights were violated in the course of his trial. Before the break, we heard a comment from a caller, Harold, who was saying, hey, this is more about power and wealth than it is about race. Anthea Butler, your thoughts on that?
Well, it is about power and wealth, but it's also about race in this way. Even the way that Harold constructed his statement by putting Bill Cosby alongside three very powerful white men basically says that he has slipped into being like a white man. In other words, he's like another powerful person, and he didn't have to pay the black tax. And I was talking to you all at the break about how there were white people who did not consider OJ to be guilty either, right? And so it was a way in which this person gets looked at because Cosby was this figure, because he was this TV star, motivational speaker, philanthropist, all of these things. You know, people thought that about Jeffrey Epstein too. But the fact of the matter is that Bill Cosby still has to deal with being black, and that most of the stuff that he did was to talk down to the black community. And this is the thing I really want to say that's going to be scary for a lot of people, and we're probably going to get some phone calls. But you know what? Bill Cosby really acted as though he didn't like most black people anyway to begin with. He always spoke down to them. He always told people to pull up their pants. He was willing to give money to, you know, educational organizations. But it was though he always tried to leave behind the projects that he grew up in.
And let me just say this. Let me share a personal story about Bill Cosby that we didn't put in the podcast because I didn't feel comfortable talking about it at the time. But when I was a reporter at the Inquirer, I had written a column about his pull up your pants pound cake tour when he came to, I think he went to a church that Michael Nutter was affiliated with at the time. And Michael Nutter co-signed all of this.
This was when he was the mayor?
Yeah, yes. This was when Michael Nutter was the mayor. And so I wrote a column saying that what makes him a moral authority, you know, with these kids, because these kids aren't buying them. Half the time, these kids only know who you are from your Cosby reruns. You're not a part of their lives. You know, you're not this authority that they can respect. And so I wrote a column saying that. Do you know that Bill Cosby called me?
See?
He called me. I mean, I was shaking because Bill Cosby is on my direct line.
Yeah.
You know, I pick up the phone and I guess his secretary or assistant says, is this Annette John Holm? Mr. Cosby would like to speak to you. And he goes on to say that what makes you think that you can write something like that, and basically chastises me and tries to get me to change what I wrote. And I said, I'm not changing what I wrote. It's my opinion. I'm entitled to that. But I was shaking and I got off the phone and I thought, this guy is a bully.
Yes, he is.
And then I realized that, I mean, when I shared this with my female journalism friends, a couple of them had gotten calls from him, too. Apparently, he reads the Philadelphia media. And, I mean, you know, he looks at Philadelphia media and he determines who he wants to bully based on what they write about him. And so when all this stuff came up, I was, when all this stuff came up about him drugging and raping women, I was like, boy, that's bully behavior. I believe that. Yeah.
Let me go hurry up and finish my article for MSNBC. So I didn't say that on NPR, but I want him to call me because I will give him an earful. Please call me, Mr. Cosby. I'm not scared of you.
You know, we're talking about race and I guess I want to highlight that there seems to be a tension in this case between two causes that are seen as kind of more progressive leaning, this fight for better oversight of the criminal justice system, specifically regarding its treatment of black men, and this push to better hear and value and act on allegations brought by women. How do you square that in this case? You know, on the one hand, you could look at this and say the criminal justice system unlawfully pulled a bait and switch on a black man. And on the other hand, you can say the victim of a sexual assault feels betrayed, as do dozens of other accusers. Deborah Turkheimer, curious if you can kind of weigh in on how that squares.
Yeah, I start from the knowledge that most sexual assault is intra-racial. And so most victims of sexual assault by white men are white women. Most victims of sexual assault by black men are black women. And so in that respect, the Cosby case is somewhat unusual. And if we're thinking about the criminal justice system's failed response to sexual assault survivors, we need to be keeping that backdrop very much in mind. As you say, the system has largely failed victims when they come forward. The failed response then leads to greater silence. We're starting to see that change in the Me Too era. But I think that the best way to look at this is to say that it really matters when someone is sexually assaulted. And for that to matter in a legal sense, we've got to do better. We've got to reconfigure our legal system's approach to these kinds of cases. And that is going to help those who have been hurt and help those who are relatively powerless. Because again, credibility corresponds to power in our society.
Curious, Anthea Butler, what do you think about this when you look at it through the lens of criminal justice reform?
You know, I'm really hoping that prosecutors who have cases like this will see the mistakes that were made here and that they will endeavor to bring these cases to trial cleanly, fairly, and justly. That's first of all. I also hope that for law enforcement, when they hear, you know, or they encounter a person who has been abused sexually, that they do this with care, that they don't ask them, well, why did you go over here with this person? I mean, you know, I cannot tell you the many times I've heard stories about people saying, well, why were you there? You didn't need to be there in the first place. That is not the question. The question is, what was done to you? How was it done to you? Was it against your will? What did you do afterwards? Is there a rape kit? You know, there's a whole other thing about talking about the rape kits that have been destroyed, that people cannot get, you know, their cases gone forward because we don't have the physical evidence. And so what my hope is that we go forward from this moment, that we continue to believe people when they say things. And if they say things that turn out not to be true, that we also are clear about that as well. I think, you know, yes, there are these cases, but more often than not, the events happened. And that is what we have to go with. We cannot begin to continue to believe people like Cosby who purport their innocence because in their world, roofing somebody or giving them a Quaalude is not a problem because that means consent because you drank the drink. Consent is not drinking the drink. Consent is not lying there like a dead person while somebody does something to you.
So the fact that Bill Cosby is free, probably sitting in his mansion today in Montgomery County, where do you place the blame? Do you place the blame in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for its decision? Do you place the blame on Bruce Castor for agreeing to this
Castor
deal?
Castor, because he's a bad lawyer to begin with, but also the Supreme Court for not figuring out that this case was going to have a lot of ramifications.
And, you know, I'm worried, Kevin. I mean, you know, about any kind of assault case. I'm worried for women about any kind of sexual assault case going forward. Because remember, Cosby did not expect that people to know about that deposition.
Right. No,
he did not expect for that deposition to be heard. It was only through the dogged reporting of my friend, AP reporter Mary Claire Dale, who submitted a Freedom of Information Act to get those depositions unsealed, that we knew about him admitting his guilt and doing these things to begin with. This was the best shot of right. women getting justice.
But that ultimately speaks to why he was released, because like you said, he didn't think that that deposition was going to become public.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But you know, it was so key in the trial that because we heard in his own words, and it turned out to backfire,
right.
you know, on the victims. But we did hear in his own words his admission of doing these things to women. We're never going to hear that from anybody again.
So I guess part of the question is, would we have rather have gone through the whole process, had all that aired out, and he served 3 years in prison and is released? Or the alternative is maybe there's just never a trial.
Well, what I do know is this, is that, you know, I mean, young people, this generation, weren't on the Cosby train anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They weren't on the Cosby train anyway.
Yeah. And this is the thing. Here's the upshot. Like most people, I would say many people, maybe 45 and up, you know, remember Cosby because they watched him on TV or whatever. Anybody 45 and under is like, I don't give a damn about Bill Cosby, except those people who are like the folks that, you know, I joked about on Twitter yesterday that this was going to be a Hotep holiday. And what I mean by Hotep is all the people who thought he was going to buy CBS or NBC or whatever network it was that he had enough money to do because he was a prosperous black man. And, you know, it was a joke, but it was kind of serious in a way. And the seriousness about this is this. Bill Cosby was looked up to as a rich, prosperous, you know, powerful black man who was able to wield a lot of, you know, moral authority and wield a lot of power. But the fact of the matter is that reputation has been crumbled. And so whatever it is that he does from this point forward, he is still going to be, you know, a convicted abuser.
Yeah.
And that's it.
We're going to read a couple of comments here. Marjorie writes in, we should not be discussing his character and should be rather focused on the technicality on which the decision is based. And that ties into something that Joan wrote and said, hey, can this be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court? Deborah Turkheimer, you want to take up that question?
It's really unlikely. The opinion by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court talks about due process and cites a few federal due process cases. So in theory, you could imagine a petition that's based on the argument that the state Supreme Court misinterpreted the meaning of due process. But again, I want to underscore, I think it's exceedingly unlikely that the U.S. Supreme Court would take this case.
And when you think about that question I asked earlier about where the blame lies in the fact that Bill Cosby is free right now, where do you put that blame, Deborah Turkheimer?
Well, I would start by going back to 2005 and looking at Bruce Castor's stated decisions for not moving forward, his issues with Andrea Constant's credibility, which, you know, we have a better understanding now of reasons why victims don't immediately report. We have a better understanding, I think, now of why victims often maintain contact with their abuser. But he decided not to proceed with the case and then made a host of decisions flowing from it that I think were not the right decisions and that got him outside of his lane. And at the same time, I think that this decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was not the right decision.
And somehow I think we've got through this hour without mentioning the fact that Bruce Castor was also the attorney for Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial that happened just in January. So just wanted to make that connection for people in case it needed to be made. Also want to read a couple comments here. Tweet from Katie: not surprised when listening to Annette, Bill Cosby spoke at my Temple University graduation and his talk was all bullying and anti-black rhetoric. And another comment here that speaks to something you said earlier, Annette: no one talks about these sexual predators, enablers. They all have people who help them, lawyers, friends, people who work for them, and they are never held accountable. That was a comment from David. One from Brian here who says, I was sexually assaulted at a Philadelphia college, and this isn't just about women. This is a comment from Brian. So thank you for offering your voice and telling your story a little bit there, Brian. Anthea Butler, what's going through your mind here in the last few minutes we have on this hour?
I want to make a comment to that person who wrote about we shouldn't be talking about Bill Cosby's character. You are part of the problem. You are part of the problem because you don't want to talk about character. You want to just talk about the facts of the case. But this is all about character. Bill Cosby talked about everybody's character when he told people to pull their pants up and everything else, and he vilified people within the black community. So I want to just heartily disagree with what you said about character, because this is all about character. This is about a character who played a moral agent on television and was an immoral agent in real life. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand what just happened here.
Annette?
Yeah. My hope is that because of the Me Too movement, that more and more women will step up. And they have. I mean, look at the number of people who, you know, have been accused by women, and women have had the courage to speak their truth about them. People from Matt Lauer and Larry Nassar and, you know, Harvey Weinstein and others. I mean, women are standing up and speaking their truth. And my hope is that this reversal of Bill Cosby does not dishearten women who have been survivors of this kind of abuse to stand up and talk about it.
And where does the Me Too movement stand at this point? Do you think that this affects the longer conversation, or is this a blip?
I hope that it helps the long-term conversation, because this is one more reason why the Me Too movement is so important, because we need to have people to support survivors and people who make these claims, and especially for the young man who wrote in and said this doesn't just happen to women. That is why Me Too exists, because we need to continue to do that, and we need to continue to support people who have been abused and who are suffering because of that abuse.
And coming up here at the end of the hour, but Deborah Turkheimer, do you want to share some closing thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the Me Too movement is about survivors coming forward and speaking their truths. It also has to be about how systems respond to those stories and how we all, outside of the legal system, respond to these stories. This reversal is yet another example of the legal system closing ranks around an abuser. And for that to end, we have to continue to evolve this conversation.
Okay, we have to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us. That was Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University, author of a forthcoming book, Credible: Why We Doubt Accusers and Protect Abusers. We were also joined this hour by Anthea Butler, professor of religious and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for being here. And Annette John Hall is the host of the WHYY podcast, Cosby Unraveled. A joy to be with you, Annette.
My pleasure, Kevin.
Our engineer today was Charlie Kyer. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Mary Bessler. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.